So yesterday we took up the theme of the Buddha's manifestation, if you like, our seeking the Buddha, and in a certain sense you could say the Buddha seeking us. And I first of all emphasised the crucial importance of having some connection with a supra self dimension, having connection with a level of consciousness, a level of awareness, a level of being that transcends me, which at the same time you can achieve, and that is embodied in Buddhism in the figure of the Buddha. The Buddha himself attained that state, and by being in contact with him in some sense, we can overcome the tendency of spiritual life to simple self-refinement, if you see what I mean. You make an effort and that just refines yourself. It doesn't get rid of your self-attachment. It becomes a better form of self-attachment, but it still circles back to you. So there needs to be an opening to a dimension, you could say within you, you could say outside you, that's all metaphor, but it's embodied in the figure of the Buddha. You open to the figure of the Buddha, and that helps you to go beyond yourself, which is what this whole Dhamma life is about. It's about giving up self-attachment, giving up self-clinging, giving up the illusion of a permanent fixed self-identity. So I was saying that you can contact the Buddha for this purpose in three different ways, primarily. You can contact the Buddha, so to speak, through history, or you can experience the Buddha trying to contact you through history. You can experience the Buddha in imagination. You can reach out to him. In a certain sense, he's reaching out to you. Certainly imaginatively, he's reaching to you. And you can reach the Buddha, or the Buddha can reach you, through the experience of the way things are, through reality itself. So yesterday I dealt, perhaps rather briefly, with the whole idea of the Buddha reaching out to you through history. In a sense, the essence of this is quite simple. The Buddha experienced the state of liberation, and he communicated from that state to others who he wanted to share that state with. He wanted others to experience what he experienced. He felt compassion for them. And he succeeded to an astonishing degree. According to the scriptures at least, many, many people gained what he gained in his own lifetime. And what he taught, the way he taught, didn't just end with his death. It continued. And it's continued for 2,500 years, and we ourselves are meeting here as a result of that communication. Well, not as a result of that communication, in that communication. From this point of view, we are in communication with the Buddha here now. This is not merely a metaphor. The Buddha taught the Dhamma. When we listen to the Dhamma, we're not just listening to an instruction manual, we're listening to the communication of the experience of that very, very great being. So if the Buddha reached out to us through history, he's still reaching out to us. He will always reach out to us. And all we have to do is make the effort to reach back to him. Especially by knowing of his life, by reflecting on his life, the great incidents in his life, and trying to reach through to the man through that life, just as we would if we read a biography of any historical figure. When you read that biography, you feel you sort of know the person. I mentioned some literary figures, but I've read so many biographies of Elizabeth I, who's always been a rather favourite character of mine. And, well, I sort of feel I know her, rather. I'm rather glad I don't live at the same time as her, because she's a pretty formidable woman. But, yeah, I certainly have a feeling that I know her. I think I could sort of almost predict her responses in certain situations. So you can reach to the Buddha in the same way through his life, even the sketchy stories that we have. You can reach to the Buddha through his own words, which we have pretty much in his own language. But of course, as translated into English and other languages, most languages in the world indeed. So you can read the scriptures, you can read especially translations of the Pali Canon, you can even read something of the Pali. It's not hard to learn a few words, just learn some ordinary members' names and then start working from there. And you can sort of find your way into the very words the Buddha used. We do the practices that he taught. When you do the mindfulness of breathing, you're in direct response to him. He said, do this. This was what I was doing when I gained enlightenment. You do it. I'm not going to him today, but it will slowly take you closer to what I experienced, and so on. So the Buddha reaches out to us through history, and we can reach back to him by studying his life, listening to his words, doing the practices that he recommended, chanting the words that he used. We don't, I think, in Tri Ratna do as much as we, in a sense, should do, of chanting the very words that he taught. There are very important suttas that are traditionally chanted throughout the Buddhist world, which we don't do so much of, like the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the Mangala Sutta, and so on. I think it'd be very good if we did that much more, so that both the meaning of the words, you have to study them, and the very words themselves, because they came from his mouth, as near as we can get to it. So yes, we can reach back to the Buddha in history. But there was always something about the Buddha, even at the time when he lived, which somewhat eluded historical analysis, if you like. It eluded the bare facts of history, the bare facts of time and space. And people obviously felt this very keenly at the time. You get this very clearly in the scriptures, in which people give expression to their experience of the Buddha, what they remember of him, what they experienced of him. And you notice three things in particular. You notice that in the records, it's very clear that many people easily saw the Buddha in what you could say idealized form. They didn't just see his sort of physical form. No doubt he was a very fine man, a very handsome man. That's often attested, that he was tall, well-built, of very fine features. And it's often said that his skin was of a golden colour. But already here, I think we're stepping from the literal into the ideal. When people saw him, they saw something sort of glowing from him that wasn't in his mere physical form. It's quite interesting the extent to which this experience of the Buddha as glowing, as having a radiance, as having an aura even, it was a common experience. Many people also attested that he had a sort of an idealized form, which was huge. Many people experienced him as much bigger than he actually was. I don't know whether I experienced this with certain individuals. Even Sangharakshita, for instance, who's actually a relatively small man. I never think of him as small, and I'm always a bit surprised when I realise he's shorter than me. You know, if I go and shake his hand or give him a hug or something like that, I find he's actually quite short. you know, I always think of Bhante as a rather fine man, a rather fine looking man, and I remember very strongly watching him giving talks. You know, I can even think of him sitting on this very spot. I'm a bit nervous now, but I remember him sitting here giving a talk just after this centre opened on a Padmasambhava day. And it was a really magical talk. I think it was one of those talks, I don't know if anybody was here. Mangala was probably, oh, Simon was here. It was one of those really magical talks where you felt Bhante was speaking from a visionary realm, a visionary dimension, and that he was in touch with something that I couldn't see, but that he was bringing out. And I certainly experienced him as glowing. I remember that especially, even more so, with talks he gave at Hampstead Town Hall on Hampstead Hill. And you were there, Subhadip? It was a series of talks on the Sutra of Golden Light. Well, Golden Light, Sutra of Golden Light. Cue for a song, Subhadip. And it's a Mahayana Sutra that he's giving, he's expounding. And yeah, there he is in his suit and his roll neck sweater and his slightly long hair and his nose that goes in a straight line from the tip to the top of his head. At the same time, it seems as if he's on fire. That's the way I didn't literally see flames coming out of him, but there was something about him that I could sense that was of another kind, of another dimension. And people felt this when they saw the Buddha. They felt that he wasn't just a physical form, that there was something glowing in him, something coming through him. And many, many people spoke of this. And an aura he had that made people respect him. I think I talked a bit about this last night, the way in which often people would resist him. They really didn't want to know. They didn't want to be impressed. They'd come determined not to be impressed. And that determination went out the window, went out the forest, the moment they clapped eyes on him. Even perhaps sometimes before that, he had a sort of an advance aura that they just had to get up, they had to salute him, they had to honour him. So yes, this is attested that there's something about him that history can't contain. There was something about him that transcended already people's historical experience, that smacked of other dimensions, of other levels. This also comes through in the historical record in terms of the Buddha having perhaps the best way we could think of it, a sort of shamanic expression. He seems to have had a magical effect on the world around him, and this is talked of in quite specifically miraculous terms. Some of that is obviously later hagiography, which doesn't mean it's invalid, but some of it is obviously not from the time of the Buddha himself. But there are, even in the earliest core, what scholars believe we cannot cut out. It did come from the very earliest core of the record. There are accounts of the Buddha in remarkable situations. I was reminded this morning, having a conversation with people over breakfast, I was reminded of an incident that happened fairly early on in the Buddha's career. He was in the vicinity of Bodh Gaya, and actually when I was there just with Dhammashalin just in November, I saw the place where this happened, Gaya Head, just between Gaya and Bodh Gaya. As a rocky outcrop, which apparently was famous for fire worshippers. And the Buddha, as was his wont, saw a crowd of ascetics and just went to them and took them on. You definitely get that sense. He went to them and he addressed himself very, very directly to them. And what he did, he said to them, I need somewhere to stay tonight. I want to stay in that hut. He said, don't go there. Don't go there. That is our fire hut. That is where the fire demon who we worship, the fire naga who we worship, lives. Don't go there. The Buddha, completely unperturbed, went in. And what the record says was that all the fire worshippers were sitting around, you know, waiting to see what would happen, perhaps with a rather sadistic glee. And it's said that they heard, you know, terrible sounds coming out of that hut. They saw clouds of smoke pouring from the hut. They saw flames issuing from the hut. They heard weird cries emanating from the hut. So they thought, there goes another ascetic. That's the end of another cheap pretender. And the next morning, they opened the door of the hut, and there was the Buddha sitting in meditation with his bowl in his lap, and in the bowl was a snake curled in the bowl. And this, according to the story, was the fire demon who had been no match for the Buddha. So what on earth are we to make of a story like that? It's not put down as a myth or something like that. It's put down as a plain fact. And there are many, many stories of this kind, that the Buddha was able to meet these shamans on their own level and go one further, defeat them. He was able to step right into the magical, mythic dimension, to function on that level, in that dimension, and to tame the forces that were unleashed. Now, there are many, many stories of him confronting demons of various kinds, yakshas, a tree spirit, of him encountering godlike forces, the thunder god, the great god Indra, who is the equivalent of the Greek Zeus, the Roman Jupiter, the Germanic Thor, and basically making them into his disciples. That's the way it's always presented. So in the traditional accounts, the Buddha is shown as functioning on a supra-historical level. He's shown encountering forces, of the deep unconscious, archetypes of the collective unconscious, if you want to put it in a depth psychological framework, encountering gods and demons, if you have a less timid and academic disposition, encountering them very, very directly, and converting them. Encountering the powerful forces that you experience in dreams at times. When you dream at times, you wake up with a start, maybe with terrible fear. I've certainly experienced this myself. And you've encountered something that you know is bigger than you, and that is even terrifying, overwhelming, awe-inspiring, and that in a certain sense threatens to crush, overwhelm, destroy you. Well, the Buddha encountered all that with perfect equanimity. He coursed in the dimension of the dream. He coursed in the dimension of the vision. He coursed in the dimension of myth. He coursed in the dimension of the magical. He coursed in the dimension of the shaman. He didn't speak the language of shamanism as in Central Asia or North Africa or whatever, but he rode his shaman's drum, you could say. He danced his shaman's dance. Whatever forces he encountered, he was able to absorb, to transform, to harmonize, even to tame, and even to convert. According to Buddhist tradition, for instance, he tamed and converted the four great kings, who are the highest peak of the mundane, ordinary mundane, you might say, that the pre-visionary mundane, the chthonic forces, which govern the world, the forces of nature, the wild, unruly forces that are present within nature. And these, according to Buddhist tradition, are sort of held in check, are sublimated and orientated by these four great kings who stand at the four quarters and order these deeply disruptive, chaotic forces. They're not evil, they're just extremely chaotic and therefore destructive if they're not given a healthy place. I think of the Erinyes in Greek mythology. You remember the Oresteia and the Eumenides, the final play in the trilogy of the Oresteia. These dark forces, the kindly ones, you cannot call them by their true name, which is the Furies, because if you do, you let them loose. And in this, those forces are sort of tamed, and they're not tamed in the sense of being crushed. They're given an honoured place in the social hierarchy by being given a temple on the a cave on the Acropolis. Well, that's on one level. On another level, on a much higher level, the Buddha was able to tame these powerful, chaotic forces by bringing them under the control of the four great kings who were his disciples. So, the Buddha moved in this visionary, shamanic world, which perhaps since Jung, since the work of C.G. Jung, we're able to take more seriously. Since the European Enlightenment and particularly the Protestant Reformation, these forces have first of all been assigned to the devil, and then to the devil of science, as it were, to the devil of nothingness, which is even worse than being the devil. They're just assigned to disbelief, which is the most dangerous thing to do to them. They become much more powerful when we don't believe in them. And they're coming back at us right now, aren't they? They're coming back at us in the destructive power of nature disrupted. So the Buddha lived at peace with these forces, and he knew how to deal with them. He's not in a whit frightened by them. Whatever the psyche had within it, he was at peace with it. Whatever nature has within it, he was at peace with it. Doesn't mean that he didn't have a healthy respect for it, that he didn't assign it a proper place. It didn't mean that he didn't give it its due. He taught that we should, in his language, make offerings to those forces. Then they will protect us. So we need to come into a healthier, positive relationship with the deep and dark forces within us, the deep and dark forces around us, by honouring, by giving offerings to. I think this is all, in a way that I'm not going to spell out, very pertinent to the whole question of ecology. I don't think ecology is simply a question of behaving more sensibly with our carbon, as it were. Of course it does involve that. It's not merely that, but it's coming into a more communicative relationship with the world around us. And this is central to the Buddha's own personal experience. He lived in the shamanic realm. He lived in the realm of the archetypes. He was at peace with it. He was at one with it. He tamed it. He lived in the highest visionary realms, those realms of visionary experience that leave no words, where it's really not possible to say what you see. He lived in the world of essences, not in the ultimate sense or metaphysical sense of essences, but of pure experience, where it's not possible really to give words to what you experience, because the barrier between subject and object is so thin. And he was at peace with that. The whole range of reality was his sphere, and he was able to roam through it at will. And this is all represented in the sutras. Those realms, of course, again, are not merely historical. In a sense, they're not historical at all. They're historical insofar as he, on one dimension, when it's historical, and we know about him through history, but he coursed in a dimension that transcended history, that reached across history. Those dimensions are present with us. They're around us now. We live at a time when they've been especially neglected, and peoples who are still retain ancient wisdom that we have lost live much more easily with those realms. But we live so far from them. Even I find that coming from the Celtic countryside of Wales into the city of London, that the spirits are so far away, that the natural forces are so far away. I had a friend from Malaysia, when we were talking about these things, sort of started saying, well, you know, when I was brought up in my village in Malaysia, these were commonplaces for us. And, you know, I experienced these forces all around me. So I said, well, what about here in Norfolk? We were in Norfolk at that time. He said, no, they're not here. Which was very sad, very sad. They are here, actually. They're sleeping. I certainly know that. The mountain behind me is a sleeping dragon. I know that. I hear its snores sometimes, and its gentle groanings as it's trying to wake up. So these realms were very much alive to the Buddha, and he could move through them at will. And those realms are not sort of bound by one particular time. They begin to defy time in our ordinary linear sense. And the Buddha has sort of spoken to us, has communicated to us through those times. And we need to reach back to him in that way. I have a little bit more to say before I come on to that question. So the people at the time of the Buddha experienced him in this sort of way, as defying the literal boundaries of the video camera. Things were going on that ordinary eyes couldn't take in, that were better expressed in myth and symbol and magical language, archetypal language, imaginative language. And all of that was vividly present to people at that time. They didn't have the same boundaries between history and imagination that we have now. And there are advantages and disadvantages to that, as I've experienced in India. It can so easily become superstition, it can so easily be exploited by social hierarchy and so on. But we've lost so much when we lose contact with that. But there's another way in which people were able to experience the Buddha, which is exceptionally beautiful, and I think it's an immediate way for us to relate to him. And the classic instance of this is found in the very earliest strata of the Pali Canon, that the scholars say that we can see in those early scriptures, on linguistic grounds and historical grounds and internal on internal grounds, we can see that the scriptures are layered. There are parts that are very clearly later. For instance, there are parts that refer to the time of the Buddha from outside that time, so they're clearly later. There are parts that refer even to teachings within the scriptures. They may not be later, they may be later in the career of the Buddha. But there are parts that are very obviously really early. The Pali, the form of the language, is different. So scholars say that some of the earliest parts are in a text known as the Sutta Nipata, which is in the fifth branch of the Sutta Pitaka, the Kudika Nikaya, the miscellaneous collection. So just for the sake of it, I'm telling you that. It's the Sutta Nipata. And there's some very, very powerful material in there. Absolutely blunt. The Buddha speaking, from under the Bodhi tree. He's not making any concessions to us. He's just saying, give it all up and experience reality. He's not beating around the bush. It's Dhamma meat, no water in it. And in this, there are some beautiful sections of people's questions to the Buddha. And a very important one that's very commonly known in our movement is the questions put by Pingya. I'm not going to put the particular questions to you, I'm not going to illustrate them, but I'm going to tell you something of what happened. So Pingya was a very old man. He'd become a follower of the Buddha, and he went to see the Buddha, and he asked the Buddha questions about the way to the beyond. How do you reach the transcendent dimension? How do you get beyond self-clinging, to put it that way? And the Buddha gave him a very direct answer. He came back and he's talking it all over with a friend of his. And the friend said something, this is my dramatic interpretation of it, the friend said something like, yeah, you know, so such a big guy, how come you're not with him all the time? You know, if he's such a great being and you think he's so wonderful, how can you resist being with him all the time? You know, one sort of imagines between the lines that he thinks he's, you know, knocked him out, as it were. So Pingya says, what makes you think I'm not with him? What makes you think I'm not with him all the time? I live with the Buddha day and night. A day and night I am in his presence. I am not present with him with my physical eyes. My eyes are flesh, but in my mind's eye he is with me all the time. So what Pingya is talking about is the eye of imagination. And in the text it's very interesting because there's no sort of stage directions. It doesn't say suddenly the Buddha came in. It doesn't say suddenly the Buddha appeared. It's just into that conversation the Buddha's words suddenly are interpolated. The Buddha simply says to him, well, if you're with me all the time, why don't you do what I say and go to the beyond? So Pingya says, you're right, here I come. And he says, from now on, you can consider me as one who has done what had to be done. So this is a very, very powerful, I was going to say metaphor, it's not a metaphor at all. It's a very powerful example of what we need to be doing. If Pingya could do it, well, why can't we? We've met the Buddha in history. We know what the Buddha lived. We know what his life was like. We've experienced in that sense, being with the Buddha, just as we've experienced in a certain sense, well, if you haven't met him, you've experienced Sangharakshita. You've experienced Elizabeth I, if you so care to. Whenever you've read a biography of anybody you admire, you've come into contact with him. I had a very striking experience of this in India this time. I gave a talk at Pune University, which is a leading faculty of Pali studies, and they were commemorating the life of Dr. Ambedkar, and I gave a talk on Dr. Ambedkar and so on, and that was very well received. And they said, would you like to stay? We're going to have a short play, and before we do that, there's somebody who wants to make an offering to you. And a man walked out from the wings, as it were, and he was dressed as Dr. Ambedkar. He had on the glasses, he had his hair parted in the way that Dr. Ambedkar had, he had something of Dr. Ambedkar's features. He was wearing a rather old-fashioned blue suit with pens in the top pocket. He had the Constitution of India under his arm, and he walked up to me with a very majestic walk, and I was expected to take these flowers from him, and you know, he was going to salute me. I couldn't do it. I had to bow in front of him because it was Dr. Ambedkar. You get my point. That, you know, this man had never met Dr. Ambedkar. I've certainly never met Dr. Ambedkar, but I've lived with Dr. Ambedkar. I've read his works. I've seen his work. I've tried to carry on his work. I've seen so many statues of him. I've seen the way in which lives have been totally changed by him. So for me, he's a living person. And, well, the Buddha could be the same. You've got to make a bit more effort. It's not hard, though. You've just got to go out a little bit out of your way, connect with the Buddha as a historical person. Once you've met him, he's with you for life. He's there all the time. You can live with him all the time, as Pingya did. And you can, as Pingya did, you can hear his teaching to you saying, come on, get off your, you know, your cushion. Escape that one quickly. Get off your cushion and go to the beyond. You can hear the message of the Buddha. So if you connect with the Buddha through history by doing what I talked about doing yesterday and reminded you of today, you can connect with the Buddha. He can become a living reality for you, which is a completely ordinary experience, one that everybody has. You know, your parents may talk about your grandparents, and you sort of feel you know them. You've seen the pictures, you've heard the stories, and they come to life for you, and so on. You can reach the Buddha in this way. He can become a living part of your life, and you can even begin to imagine him in a quite direct way. You may not have a particularly good visual imagination, and I think this is something that's very important not to over-identify with the task as being to do with visualization. It's a very powerful way of experiencing the visual sense. Is a particularly sort of powerful one. It has a veracity that the other senses don't have to the same degree. But you may not have that. I think, although I do have a quite a strong visual capacity, a visualizing capacity, it doesn't tend to be a very orderly one. It tends to jump around all over the place. I find it more difficult to steady it. But what I do find is happens reasonably spontaneously. I can feel the Buddha's there, right in front of me. I can feel the Buddha is here. I don't have to try very hard. The Buddha is here, embodied before us. And you can feel that. You know, you're sitting here and there are people behind you, and without looking back, you know they're there. You can sense their presence. There's a sort of spatial locatory sense which can sense presences. Or you know that weird thing when you go into a room and you suddenly think, somebody else here. I know there's somebody else here. And you know, then you look behind the door and there's somebody there. That sort of thing. You know, that scene in The Seven Samurai where each of the samurai comes to the door to be tested, and they're waiting behind the door with sticks, and each of the good, you know, the really good samurai comes to the door, stops, knows there's something there, reaches around, grabs the person, throws them across the room. And then Toshiro Mifune, who's the clumsy samurai, just wanders straight in and is bashed on the head. Well, it's that sort of capacity to sense somebody there. You know, that said that the greatest karate or martial arts experts can fight blindfold. They can sense the presence of the of their adversary. So, do you see what I mean? We're talking about an ability that we have naturally to sense presence, which is quite deep and quite powerful, very, very important to us. It's if we couldn't do that, I would be looking at simply a field of shapes. They will be unanimate. Is that a word? Disanimate. I don't know. Inanimate. Thank you. Phew. I like disanimate or unanimate. They would be out, without animation. You would be just a bunch of cardboard cutouts, you know, like you get on Indian political platforms. So it's because I'm able to invest you with presence, well, that it's worth bothering to talk to you. So that sort of sense of presence is a natural function that we have, and that I think is in some ways one of the most powerful forces of imagination that we have. It's what makes it possible to communicate. And it very easily brings the Buddha present to us. Once you've had a historical sense of the Buddha is present to you. Just to labour the point a bit more, I did a long solitary retreat from which so many illustrations come in my talks. As alone for 5 months and out of contact for eight, mainly out of contact with for eight. And you know, I was thinking, phew, I'm all alone. I realised I wasn't alone at all. Everybody was with me all the time. You know, whatever I wanted or not, people were around me and part of me and. Sometimes benignly, sometimes malignly, but they were there all the time, in quite literal and definite senses. And I certainly experienced Sangharakshita as a constant presence in my retreat, and increasingly the Buddha a constant presence in my retreat, as I focused upon him more and more, read the Pali Canon more and more. I felt the Buddha present with me, unfortunately not as constantly as would have been good for me, but pretty constantly. So yes, don't think only in terms of visualizing, of creating an image. Sort of look to see how that historical connection with the Buddha is carried with you in your living experience. And deliberately foster it without forcing it. If you see what I mean, you foster it by paying attention to it. The Buddha himself says that what the mind tends to, that the mind becomes. So if you give your mind to something, your mind increasingly becomes like that. So if you watch horror movies, your mind will become increasingly horrified. If you give your mind to, well, we won't even mention what we often give our minds to, that's what your mind will become. If you give your mind to trivia, you will have a trivial mind. If you give your mind to great works of art, your mind will be uplifted and raised. So what you give your mind to, that your mind becomes, and that becomes a stronger and stronger presence with you. You certainly experience this when you come from a retreat, don't you? You've been giving your mind to somewhat loftier, somewhat more refined objects. And when you come off retreat, that continues for a while. You continue to be able to connect with that dimension. Even in the dirt and grime of the city, something shines. So give your mind to the Buddha. Connect with the Buddha. And let the Buddha come to life for you. So this is the practice known as Buddhanusmriti, recollection or mindfulness of the Buddha. Imagining the Buddha would be a much better way of putting it. realize it's not a question of forcing something into your mind, but drawing something out of your mind. Insofar as the Buddha reached across historical time and space to us, he's also reached across imaginative or imaginal time and space to us. Imaginal time and space are curved, points in historical space and time that are far distant, in imaginal space and time, can be absolutely simultaneous, asynchronous, can be present at the same time in space and time. So through history you connect with the Buddha, through imagination you dwell with the Buddha. And it's a fundamental practice of Buddhism, which has become a very rich and highly developed field in Buddhist tradition, in the whole field of visualization in all Buddhist traditions, even the so-called most sober tradition of Southeast Asia, the Theravada tradition. Still, the imagination of the Buddha is a crucial aspect. In Tibetan Buddhism, we're very familiar with the rich imaginative world of contact with the Buddha that's developed in Chinese Buddhism, in Japanese Buddhism, in all forms of Buddhism this develops. And you know, you won't be able to stop some people from seeing the Buddha. I've had people come to me saying that you know, without knowing anything about Buddhism, the Buddha has come to them. They've experienced a vision of the Buddha. I remember Bhante saying to me that he was once visited by a Muslim in India, and even at that time, for a Muslim, betrayal of the faith was a death matter. And he said that this man said that he'd been sitting one day, and a figure had appeared to him without any, you know, premonition or predisposition, and he'd not understood what that figure was. It had had a very powerful effect upon him, and then in trying to work out what this was, he'd come across an illustration of the Buddha somewhere, and he realized that that figure was the Buddha. So he'd come to Sangharakshita as a Buddhist monk and told him of this. I've had something of that experience myself with a Muslim who came to me and said that he had a very powerful experience of the Buddha, and that, well, he spoke very strongly against the oppression of women in Islam. And he said he refused to treat his own wife the way his family wanted him to treat her. He'd refused to leave his daughters in ignorance, and that he was being cast out of that community. He's still in contact with us, fortunately. So the Buddha doesn't come necessarily in a nice, orderly way. The imagination, the world of the vision and so forth isn't nice and neat and orderly. It stretches across time and reaches into the visionary dimension of our experience. What we mainly need to do, coming from the somewhat desiccated cultures that some of us come from in the West, is bring that dimension to life in other ways. I talked about this in my last series of rambles. You know, you can listen to the series if you want to catch up with it. I've written about it as well. We need to give attention to developing our imaginations so that we can connect with the Buddha. Well, first of all, we need to do it because it's part of a true human life. A human being without imagination is a terrifying thing. Gosh, where am I getting this from? Somebody said, "Beware of a man who cannot dream." It was one of the great poets. And Blake said something about he who cannot imagine breeds pestilence. If you cannot access the realms of the realms of vision, the imaginative realms, that the realms of connection with nature, and nature is alive, if you cannot connect with art as expressing a richer human experience, if you cannot connect with dreams, if your dreams are not important to you, an important part of your life, if your intuitions, your impulses, your moments of mad visionary experience, your moments of seeing things in the oddest of ways are not valued, or they become destructive, manipulative, they become a pestilence. Yes, they breed pestilence. So we need, just for human health, to incorporate that dimension. Well, not incorporate it, that sounds like we're, you know, going to put it in a drawer and make it tidy. But honour that dimension, come into a healthy dimension with it, a healthy relationship with us, with it. Because it's not us, it's something more than us. These figures are not us. I think it's a way of desiccating the imaginative when we see it all as expressions of us. I think we leech it of significance, we reduce it to our poor little feeble egos, which are really quite laughable. You know, I'm reading a Hungarian author, this complicated non-entity, the ego, which should be treated with sympathetic patience and tenderness, sympathetic tenderness and gentle irony. And that's what you're able to do. This man was a great artist, a great writer. You're able to do when you're in contact with these dimensions as alive, as more than I. What you encounter is not, oh, that must be me. It's not you at all. It's what it is. So we need to come into that sort of respect and honour to those things that are somehow directly connected with us, but are the more than us. From all dimensions, from below us, chthonic dark forces within us, and from above us, the sky gods, if you like. The whole lot, the whole range, we need to come into a healthy relationship, just as human beings. But it's the Buddha can speak to us through those dimensions. He speaks to us through those dimensions, but he's more than those dimensions. He appeared to Pingya in those dimensions, but he said to Pingya, go beyond this dimension. Touch on what I really am. Go to what I have reached. Go beyond. I've shown you the way to the beyond. Go beyond. So, yes, we need to reach to the Buddha in imagination. Actually, it's much better to think of it as allowing the Buddha to reach to us in imagination. I think the imagination shouldn't be seen of as something that's in our control. It's in our control to give it space, but once we've given it space, it comes in its own way, in its own time. You know, I spoke last time of Keats's talk of negative capability, the capacity to dwell amongst uncertainties, mysteries, and doubts, and letting go of the irritable reaching after resolution. So opening up to a dimension that has its own life, its own mysterious ways, that the imagination is a spirit, it bloweth where it listeth, to quote the good book, which has many a good line, and much good wisdom about this dimension. Especially, you know, the prophets, they knew all about this. It's the prophetic dimension. Yes, we need to open up to this dimension, give it honour, give it a value, give it its own life, let it live, not try to force it in this direction or that direction. But if we've connected with the Buddha, we give a space to the Buddha, he will appear. He will appear in that space. And when he appears really vividly to us, he will tell us to go beyond. And he will appear to us in his real form. You get this often, don't you, in myth. You get a very beautiful myth. The myth of Semele, do you remember that? Semele, who one of the many maidens who Zeus wanted to seduce, and well, she resisted him, but he was obsessed with her. Hera, his wife, became jealous and eventually tricked her. He said, well, tell him that you will give in only if he will appear in his true form. So she did, she gave in, as mortals must to the gods eventually. And so then she held him to his promise. As you said, don't go there, don't ask me that. But she said, no, you must. You promised, you vowed, a god's vow is a vow that cannot be broken. So he had to appear in his real form. And of course, in his real form, she was totally destroyed. She was burnt to cinder. In the ashes, of course, was the god Dionysus, which is another story. But gods have their own reality. And the Buddha is not a god. He's more than a god. And when he appears to you, he appears to you in the form that you can see. And in this case, you do need to ask the Buddha to appear in his real form. You will be burnt to nothing. But what will be left will be something really wonderful, something new. The new you, the new you, the you reborn. The you reborn indeed as a Buddha. So, yes, we allow the imagination to live. We invite the Buddha to enter that imagination. We invite the Buddha to live and speak to us through imagination. And when he speaks to us through imagination, he offers us the opportunity to connect with who he really is. And when we encounter who he really is, we will be unalterably and totally transformed. And what we will be transformed into is what this whole Dhamma life that we've contacted is all about. So we'll find out tomorrow a little bit more about that, what that real form is. God, I just realised what I've said, but we will try to find out more about what that real form is. What is it that the Buddha is, really is? He's not that figure that lived 2,500 years ago and taught at Bodh Gaya, or rather gained enlightenment at Bodh Gaya, taught all over North India, whose teaching has come to us. He's not that figure. He's not even the forms that, maybe even as I'm speaking, something is coming for you. Something is there, and I can't believe that will be completely eluded you. However much you may resist, the Buddha is very strong, and he will be trying to get through. He's dialing, however much you may refuse to lift the phone. But he's not that. He's not even that. He's something else. And what that something else is, I will humbly try to bring you a bit closer to. So that's, I think, a very good recommendation to coming back tomorrow. And I'm terrified myself. Because that's what I like about these rambles, that I'm never completely sure where I'm going to go, and I certainly didn't quite go where I meant to tonight. I didn't expect to, but I'm very satisfied with where I've gone. But I wish I hadn't been quite so bold about where I said we were going to go tomorrow, and I will try to do some meditation and get us there.